At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
They are Sports Illustrated.
It's amazing.
This incredible body of work.
I really appreciate the integrity.
Everything you do is well done.
You guys do a great job.
We love it. What can we say?
He's Chris Mannix.
He's employed by Sports Illustrated.
The announcer's got it in for me.
There you go.
This is the Crossover NBA Podcast.
You have a problem with it? Build a team that can beat them.
Hosted by the one and only.
Oh, thank God.
Thank God.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Crossover NBA Podcast. Glad you could join me this week, and we have a terrific show lined up for you. First up, Rohan Nadkarni, the great writer over at Sports Illustrated. Rohan and I talk about the Milwaukee Bucks, where they rank among Eastern Conference contenders. They're number one atop the standings, but are they the team to beat in the Eastern Conference? The Bucks also signed Eric Bledsoe to a four-year, $70 million extension. We talk a little bit about that. We talk about the stakes in the Eastern Conference playoffs, from Boston to Philadelphia to Toronto, a lot of teams with a lot on the line. And towards the end, we talk about the Trae Young versus Luka Doncic debate. Luka Doncic just won his fourth straight Rookie of the Month award, but Trae Young, he has been doing some impressive things. We talk about all that and more with Rohan Nadkarni. A little bit later on, I check in with Andre Ingram, a guy you may remember at the end of last year, inspirational story, called up from the South Bay Lakers to the Los Angeles Lakers while in his early 30s. Well, Andre is back in the G League and continuing to fight for his dream to make the NBA. I have an extended conversation with Andre on this podcast. Stick around for that and much more. That's it. All right, let's go. All right, joining me now, you've heard him here many times before, he is Rohan Nadkarni, the co-host of the Crossover TV show. I don't feel like we give you enough pub for that, Rohan, so we'll give you a little pop there, and a staff writer over at Sports Illustrated. What's up, man?
When do I get to become co-host of the Crossover podcast?
That would be never.
Never, okay.
That would be never. You
it's
are
a solo
a,
show. I
you're
see.
Like... You're like the Andy Richter to my Conan O'Brien.
Wow. Okay.
We'll go with that. Because Andy Richter never got, you know, the Tonight Show with Andy Richter, late night with Conan and Andy. He never got that distinction.
No. It's an honor to be your sidekick, Chris.
You know what I realized by following you on social media, Rohan? Someday, I want to love someone like you love Dwayne Wade. Like, I do. Like, I want to love someone the way you love Dwayne Wade.
You know, I hope you get to experience that because it's one of the most beautiful feelings in the world. So I also hope one day you love someone as much as I love Dwayne Wade.
Like if you, you know, someday have a child, you're going to name him Zaire?
No, I'm going to name my son Yuvraj after the 2011 man of the tournament in the Cricket World Cup.
But glad you already thought of
that.
Yeah.
Okay. But, you know, maybe Dwayne is a middle name or something.
Dwayne, there you go. Okay, gotcha. All right, let's jump right into it. The NBA's best record right now, it currently belongs to the Milwaukee Bucks. The Bucks are 48-15. They also have the league's best road record. They have a top five offense, the number one defense, and the best net rating in the entire NBA. Yet there are some, Rohan, people across the league that I've heard this from multiple different people, and we touched on this briefly last week, that will tell you that they believe this Bucks team is built for regular season success more than it is for playoff success. If the Bucks finish the year with the number one seed, are they the favorite in your mind to win the East?
You know, you might have to lump me in with some of those people. I think I'm a little bit of a Bucks skeptic. Now, let me say why. First of all, we've seen teams like this before, right? You remember the Derrick Rose Bulls. They'd always finish ahead of LeBron's Heat in the Eastern Conference, but couldn't quite get over the hump in the playoffs. We saw it with Toronto last year, number one seed. looked like this was their year. You know, that was their year to make the finals. It didn't work out. Now, obviously, the Bucks have Giannis, which is just a huge game changer in terms of a playoff series. But here are my concerns. Number one, I think a lot of their success is predicated on, you know, spreading the floor with Brook Lopez on the court. How effective is he going to be in the playoffs, especially defensively, when teams are maybe targeting him more so than they are now? Now, Milwaukee already has the number one defense in the league. They've proven they can defend with Lopez on the court. What end up might working in Milwaukee's favor is the fact that it seems like teams don't necessarily want to play small anymore, especially in the East. You have Embiid, you have Horford, you have Gasol, you have Lopez. It might work in Milwaukee's favor that they don't have to play small. Obviously, they can play small with Mirotić, but then they're not playing, you know, quote unquote, their best lineup. So that remains to be seen to me. Two, I mean, we saw it a little bit, you know, down the stretch of that Lakers game. The other night, which Milwaukee won, they came back. Eric Bledsoe played incredibly well. Giannis doesn't necessarily have the ball in his hands at the end of games. Now, part of that is because teams don't respect his shooting. Part of that is because he's not a knockdown free throw shooter. But there are times during the stretch, you know, of tight games where Giannis, you know, isn't standing at the top of the key with his ball in his hands. That is an interesting wrinkle. When the best player on your team isn't an obvious, you know, toss him the ball, go get a bucket guy at the end of a game. I want to see this core again in the playoffs. Obviously, they played Boston really well last year. Ended up, you know, playing Boston the best out of anyone until Cleveland, at least. So I just want to see their group in the playoffs, because can Eric Bledsoe step up like he did in that Lakers game for a playoff series? We saw him struggle in the postseason last year with Terry Rozier. Is Chris Middleton good enough to be that quote-unquote second star? I'm not down on their playoff hopes. I just need to see it before I get truly excited about it.
I agree with everything you said there, especially when it comes to Brook Lopez, who's been a big part of this team's defensive identity for most of the season. But it is fair to wonder, when you get into a 7-game series and a good coaching staff is going to have one team and one player to focus on, are there areas of Brook Lopez that you can exploit, whether it's the pick and roll or just keeping him on the perimeter and making him guard smaller, quicker players? The flip side of that, though, is that they have the ability to play small ball as well as anyone. I mean, you put Giannis at 5, and I mean, you know what I love about Giannis these days? It's like he's testing a new part of his game, which is seeing if he can bully his way to dunks. And I don't know about you, but I don't think I can remember a better offhand dunker than Giannis. Because Giannis these days, you saw the dunk on Mike Muscala, and he did it on a couple of other guys. He's just like dipping that shoulder and going straight at you and dunking on you with the offhand, which is just incredible to watch as often as I feel like I've seen it. So they can play small with Giannis, and in that context, don't really need him to be a knockdown three-point shooter. My questions with Milwaukee, you kind of touched on it, have more to do with inexperience. And you know, they just add Pau Gasol, who's the only guy there with championship experience now on the roster. I'm not sure what he's going to be able to really add to that team in the postseason, given what their rotations currently look like. But, you know, they haven't done it before. And you mentioned Eric Bledsoe, and he was outplayed by Terry Rozier in the playoffs last year. It seemed like Rozier did get in his head last year. What happens, you know, against a better point guard, a better team, a more experienced team? This team just hasn't shown it yet. I think that's the biggest knock against them.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. About Giannis's dunks, by the way, I mean, what he's doing is basically a throwback to guys like Shaq, a throwback to guys like Hakeem Olajuwon, the way he just kind of takes over guys in the post. I think the issue is you still have to defend him like a perimeter player. So you see guys, you know, throw small forwards on him or whatever, and then he's just bullying his way and dunking. It's insane to watch.
He's not even doing it like Shaq, though. He's starting at the perimeter.
Right,
like
right. That's
he's
what
going
I'm saying.
Off
That's
the dribble, yeah. And like he's making initial contact at like the circle. Like he's getting his shoulder into you and just banging you. So unless you're in perfect position to take a charge, he's just going to run you over and get an and one. I mean, poor Mike Muscala on that play that I remember. I mean, he just got bulldozed out there.
Yeah. One thing I want to add in about the East, because we're kind of talking about, you know, the playoffs, matchup basketball, something that to me I think is going to emerge as a storyline that I really got my eye on is, I think for years everyone was building their roster to defend the Warriors in a certain sense, right? Because you couldn't have a center on the floor who couldn't switch out onto a point guard, because that means, A, you're not really a title contender because you can't beat the Warriors. And B, that's just where the league was headed. You have to have big guys who could switch out onto guards. You have to be able to switch on defense or at least have some kind of strategy so that late in the shot clock, whatever, your big man isn't being exposed. We're seeing the East contenders kind of go away from that right now, aren't we? I mean, Boston has Horford. It has Baines. The Sixers have Embiid or Boban. The Bucks now have Pau Gasol, who I think, you know, probably won't play much, but they have Lopez. They have DJ Wilson. That's an interesting wrinkle to me, is it seems like the top teams in the East, you know, the Raptors have Gasol and Ibaka now. The top teams in the East are kind of going away from the trend that we've seen playoff basketball have the last couple of years. And I'm curious how that's going to serve them, you know, in a potential final series.
It feels weird to be so skeptical of Milwaukee. I mean, the point differential
for
the
Bucks, their net rating is way better than the Warriors.
Their net rating is better. Their point differential is better. You know, put in context, their point differential this year is 9.3. The next best is Golden State at 6.5. They're almost 3 points per game better than the next best team that's out there. And we're now 63, 64 games into the season. Like, this isn't a fluke. This is who the Bucks are. And I don't know. Maybe we're just underestimating them. But I don't know that anyone's going to see Milwaukee as the number one seed and say that's the prohibitive favorite in the same way they'd probably see Golden State as the number one seed.
I think what's holding back Milwaukee and our expectations and anyone who is skeptical is they are bucking the trends of what we've come to learn from title contenders, right? They're not loaded with top tier talent. Now Giannis is a generational talent. There's no doubt about it. But Middleton, who's a very, very, very good player, a great player, an all-star this year, isn't the typical second star we've grown accustomed to. He's not a Kyrie Irving like he was for the Cavs. He's not even a Klay Thompson. So I think what's holding them back is the fact that they play as big as they do with Brook Lopez, and B, the fact that they just don't have that kind of top-tier talent that we've at least come to assume you need to be a championship contender.
You know, one interesting move the Bucks made outside of Pau Gasol was they made the rare late season extension deal with Eric Bledsoe. Bledsoe was given a 4-year, $70 million contract extension by the Bucks. Good deal for Bledsoe, of course, and I think a great deal for Milwaukee, which gets a starting point guard at, I would say, below market value. I mean, 4 years, $70 million is a pretty good number for a 29-year-old point guard having one of the best seasons of his career. Now, Bledsoe's minutes are down, I think the fewest minutes since the 2012-13 season. But if you spread his minutes out over the per 36, he's given you a career high in assists, rebounds, field goal percentage. He's been excellent for this team all season long. What did you make of the Bledsoe extension this past week?
I'm really fascinated by Milwaukee's future. First of all, let me say I'm happy for Eric Bledsoe. I'm glad he got himself out of Phoenix. You know, Kevin Arnovitz had a great story for ESPN today about just how much of a shit show it is in Phoenix. So I'm happy for Eric Bledsoe. Good for him. I think he's a really good player. I hope he gets a chance at redemption in the postseason. Here's what I'll say about the extension. Milwaukee's future is one of the most interesting situations in the league to me, because if you remember, it wasn't long ago, a year or two ago, when people were having the conversations about Giannis that they're having about Anthony Davis now. They were talking about, would he potentially turn down that Supermax extension? Our team circling the calendar about when they can get in on the Giannis race. When John Horst took over, there was a lot of tension. People didn't think that was a slam dunk move. Now, obviously, the roster looks great. You know, the team is playing really, really well. Giannis is going to have to make that extension decision next season. But here's why my mildest bit of concern with the Bledsoe deal is this. Why I would have maybe waited until the offseason to do this. Do you know what you're getting from this core in a playoff run? That's the question Milwaukee has to ask itself. Because let's say you extend Bledsoe. You're probably going to want to extend Malcolm Brogdon this summer, who's going to be a restricted free agent. He's going to get a good offer sheet. Chris Middleton, you're almost definitely going to have to bring back on a max contract, because one of these teams that strikes out is going to get desperate, right? Maybe the Lakers get desperate. So let's assume Brogdon gets a substantial deal, Middleton gets a max contract, Bledsoe's getting a slight raise, and then, you know, 2 years from now, Giannis is going to be under that supermax deal. Milwaukee's flexibility is gone once they start making these moves. Once these dominoes start falling, they have to have the utmost confidence that this current core can bring them a championship. Now, one thing that's working in their favor, if Durant leaves, I think that changes the calculus of team building a little bit. you might be able to, you know, not have the loaded super team. You might be moving away from that era. But just, I would have maybe, if I'm taking the view of entirely as a front office person, I would have maybe wanted to see what the core can do in the playoffs, because once these dominoes start falling, they're locked into this core.
Yeah, and well, look, one of your things you brought up was that you've got to max out Middleton because somebody else is likely to do it. And I agree with that. I think there's no way that Bledsoe was getting a max level contract, but he could have gotten an offer that was more substantial
right.
than the 4 years and $70 million they ultimately got him for. So I think it's a calculated risk by Milwaukee. The only question I had, because I had thought for the last few months that Milwaukee, because of the space they could create this summer, they might have been a player for Kemba Walker. If the Hornets, you know, kind of fooled around with Kemba and didn't make him the 5 year max level offer, then I thought Milwaukee could have jumped in there and given, you know, Giannis that second all-star, what, you know, third, I guess, with Chris Middleton, then that they would have been able to acquire a guy like Kemba Walker. I thought it made a lot of sense there. But I'm also not convinced that Kemba Walker at his size, you know, at some point, are you paying significantly for past performance? So I don't mind this deal at all, especially considering the contract terms that are there. I'm with you. If they get beaten the first round or even the second round and Bledsoe looks bad, you have to start wondering about this team's future. But you know, this summer was going to be a tough summer for them regardless. This is kind of the team they have, and you know, they're going to have to use their first and second round picks very smartly over the next year or so to make sure they get talent to play alongside these guys.
Yeah, their front office is going to be under a lot of pressure to make sure they nail these moves on the margins. I mean, Giannis actually ended up, the only reason they might have space this summer, Giannis ended up giving them a pretty solid discount last time. They kind of just got lucky with the way the CBA was working at the time. But I'm just really interested to see what happens with this team, because if Durant leaves the Warriors and he ends up on the Knicks with Kyrie Irving, I think the whole landscape of title teams is going to change. I think that window is going to open up for some teams. So Milwaukee could benefit from that more than any other team in the league, but it's going to be very interesting. I also think they should try to bring back Mirotić, by the way, who's another free agent this summer.
Yeah, I'd like to see how Mirotić fits in alongside these guys in the postseason, see if he has the same impact as he had last year.
They have a very promising on-paper lineup of Bledsoe, Brogdon, Middleton, Mirotić, and Giannis. That lineup is like a dream small ball lineup. So, but they haven't used it too much yet.
And they brought Powell back, which could create a potential Gasol conference finals matchup, which is always something, you know, worth writing about down the line.
Sure.
Let me ask you though about these Eastern Conference playoffs. There's a lot at stake for a lot of teams there, especially those teams sitting inside that top five. But when you look at those top five teams there, who has the most at stake? Who has the most to lose with an early exit in the playoffs?
That's so interesting. I mean, there's no wrong answer for this one, right? Because a lot of kind of free agent stakes, this and that, rest on this. I almost think I'm talking myself into it being the Sixers only because they've really pushed their chips to the middle of the table right now. Let's say the disaster scenario happens for the Sixers, okay? They get Boston in the first round and they lose because they just can't get past the Celtics. It's their worst matchup. Then let's say Jimmy Butler leaves because the Sixers don't really want to bring him back anyway, and he wants to go to the team that's going to pay him the most. And then let's say someone swoops in with a max offer for Tobias Harris and Philly's just not totally comfortable matching it, or whatever reason, maybe Tobias Harris wants to play somewhere else. There are paths out of this postseason where the Sixers have pushed their chips. They've traded Markel Fultz. They've traded Robert Covington, who's on a great contract, Dario Saric, Landry Shamet, who's playing really well for the Clippers. They've pushed a lot of chips to the middle of the table. And if they don't come away this postseason with at least giving the proper reason for their guys to stay, I mean, they could end up losing a lot out of this.
Yeah, I agree with you on Philadelphia, because how do you pay all that money for a team that got beat in the first round?
Yeah.
I mean,
that's the worst case for them. I don't think they want to bring back Jimmy Butler.
I think it's possible that they would let Jimmy Butler walk, or at least lowball him with an offer if they get beat in the first round. But Butler remains the guy that is the only realistic option as a fourth quarter scorer. I mean, he's the guy you have to go to get a bucket. He's the only guy on the roster capable of doing it. I mean, Embiid is excellent and gets the free throw line a lot and, you know, succeeds when he gets there. But he's not that type of guy. And I don't think Tobias Harris is that type of guy. And I certainly don't think Ben Simmons yet is that type of guy. But I'm going to go with Toronto on this one because, I mean, the future of the franchise is basically at stake here. I mean, if they get beat in the second round against Boston or against Philadelphia or whomever, if they get beat in the second round, chances are even higher than they are right now that Kawhi Leonard walks. Now, there are so many people that I talk to on a regular basis that believe Kawhi to the Clippers is a done deal. I hear that so often across the league. And the only thing you can say that might counter that is that Kawhi is such a kind of unique personality that he may just have one opinion on what he wants to do, and everybody around him has a difference of opinion. And that's happened before. I mean, you know, I don't know that people inside Paul George's camp necessarily wanted him to stay in Oklahoma City or saw that, or I know they saw other opportunities that existed in Los Angeles, but Paul George developed that connection with Russell Westbrook, developed that connection with the Thunder organization, and decided to stay. Not that they're the same type of people, but you know, Kawhi could say, you know, could decide, you know, I just want to be here. So, all that being said, if they get beat in the second round, I'm not sure they have any chance of keeping him. If they get to the finals, I think there's a great chance of keeping him. But if they get beat in the second round, I don't know if they keep him. And if they can't keep Kawhi Leonard, I think that will signal the start of a teardown in Toronto. I think that's something that the front office there has, on some level, wanted to do for a while. And I think that you'll see maybe a Kyle Lowry trade, maybe a Serge Ibaka trade. You'll keep the young guys that make sense, the Pascal Siakams, the Van Vliets, the young players on this team. But if Kawhi goes, I think you can see the top money-making talent on that roster go with him.
What's so interesting about Toronto is how much of their chances of keeping Kawhi depend on their postseason success, but how much their postseason success depends on Kawhi. You know what I mean? If Kawhi is playing like he was, you know, in 2017, or when he looked like one of the best players in the world, top three guy, then yeah, I think they have a great chance of making the finals. I mean, I wrote about this, but if, you know, Kawhi's won a finals MVP already. I believe he's the only guy in the East who's actually playing a lot of minutes on a playoff team that's won a finals MVP, or at least certainly in that top four group. I mean, if they get that guy, then they have a good a chance as anyone to make the finals. So it's almost like it's kind of in Kawhi's hands. You see what I'm saying? If Kawhi reaches that next level, he can take this team to the finals, and then he gets to decide if he wants to stay. I don't know. So it's a kind of a weird situation.
Could he walk away from a finals team? Like, can you really do that?
I mean, it's not. He didn't quite walk away from a finals team in San Antonio, but he walked away from an incredibly stable organization. That's already.
But it was one he had issues with. Like, yes. It was one he had significant issues with. And to my knowledge, there have not been anywhere near those types of issues in Toronto. Toronto, by the way, known for their medical staff as well. Like, they've got a high-level medical staff out there. Right. Kawhi's had no problems physically this year.
Yeah, I think it's possible, especially because he's won a championship already. You know, he's not one of those guys that needs to ring chase, or, you know, he's got the accolades. He's got a finals ring. He's got a finals MVP. He beat LeBron in that series. I think he's earned the right in his own mind, and that's all that matters, to go somewhere if he wants to go somewhere. It doesn't matter how far they make it.
Yeah, if they make the finals, though, I just can't see him walking away. That would, I don't know if that would be a first, but it certainly would be different, would be rare to see something like that actually happen.
LeBron James did it.
Yeah, he did it, yeah. I guess. That's true. Four straight finals and walked away from that. But, I mean, there was also a sense, too, that, you know, LeBron's teams, he kind of knew he wasn't going to be able to win with that group. That group was kind of plateaued. I don't know if the Raptors have plateaued. I mean, I think you're going to see in the coming years, we've already seen a big step forward from Pascal Siakam.
Yeah, like, I think Van Vliet's their future at guard. I mean,
absolutely.
Like, Lowry can get them another piece.
Van Vliet is equipped to, if they traded Kyle Lowry anyway, or they just kind of let him sort of age out and depart as a free agent after, what is it, next season? Van Vliet's already there to take over and be that guy, creating maybe some more cap flexibility for him to go out and do something else. All right, a couple of things I wanted to hit on, and this one kind of came up on in the Twitterverse over the last few weeks. That's the debate between Brandon Ingram and Jason Tatum. And this sort of came up during the talks between the Pelicans and the Lakers and everything centered on the Celtics. There's been a long-standing belief, Rohan, that Jason Tatum is the best player in any deal that could involve the Lakers or Celtics. effectively meaning Jason Tatum, is a better trade piece than Brandon Ingram, Kyle Kuzma, Lonzo Ball, anyone that the Lakers have had to offer. In the last couple of weeks, I've seen some suggestions that Ingram has either closed the gap or is on that same type of level. I mean, he had a game last Friday where we just talked about the Bucks. He had 31 points against the Bucks. A couple of days before that, he had 30-plus points. He's had 30-plus points in two of his last four games. Do you think that Brandon Ingram has closed that gap? And who do you think is the better prospect between Ingram and Jason Tatum? Because Tatum, while his numbers are up this year, he certainly has not had the same type of impact this year as he had as a rookie.
It's very interesting. I think that Ingram has definitely closed the gap. I think it's way closer than we thought at the beginning of the season. You know, Ingram's had 6-7 games in a row now where he's probably put together the best stretch of his career. Certainly the best he's looked playing alongside LeBron. It is a little worrisome that hasn't necessarily resulted in wins for the Lakers, but he looks a lot better. What makes it frustrating to me when people compare these players is that they were put in such incredibly different situations. I mean, the Lakers have been a mess of an organization for 5 or 6 years in a row now, whereas Tatum was getting drafted to a team that was already very successful, had gotten a lottery pick because of trading, not because they were bad, and he was kind of eased into his role. Obviously, in the playoffs, there was a much bigger spotlight on Tatum, but he'd had a kind of a whole year of seasoning, playing behind guys, playing behind Kyrie Irving, that he didn't have to be kind of that go-to option right away, whereas Ben Ingram's just kind of dealt with a lot of stuff in his career already, a lot of changes to the roster, a lot of changes to his role, and I think that has played a role in why we don't see him as good as Tatum yet. If I had to pick right now, I think I would still pick Tatum for the future, if only because his game just makes a little bit more sense to me. Is Brandon Ingram, do you want him handling the ball more? Like, it seems like Lakers fans are always having that conversation on Twitter. Should he kind of be the nominal point guard in a sense? So in that, I think I would still take Tatum, but I think it's way closer, and I think it's just impossible to know with these guys because they've been in such wildly different situations early in their careers. And one thing I'll say about these Lakers guys, you've seen the kind of the leap D'Angelo Russell has taken. I think there are a lot of reasons why he's a lot better player now that he's out of Los Angeles. And I don't think Luke Walton is a bad coach, but I do think some of these Lakers guys do better when they're not in LA anymore, especially with just kind of the circus that's been around that team the last few years. You can't really say the same for people who leave the Celtics. So that's another kind of wrinkle to throw into this.
Yeah, I think that's true, though I would say that the D'Angelo Russell situation is unique.
It's layered.
I mean, whatever. Russell brought a lot of that onto himself. Maybe he had to get out of LA to, really start to blossom as a player. I would still take Jason Tatum, but I like what I've seen from Ingram. There's a flip side to your argument about, Tatum has been able to kind of ease his way kind of into it. I don't think Jason Tatum wanted to ease his way into it. I think Jason Tatum would have been happy picking up right where he left off at the end of last season as the 1-1A scoring option on a high-level winning team. I think he's capable of that, just like I thought Jaylen Brown was capable of that. I think having to step into the kind of the shadows and a secondary role has hurt the development of Jason Tatum. And I think if you put Tatum in a situation like Ingram is in Los Angeles, where he is the second option on that team after LeBron, I think he'd be putting up comparable numbers. I do. I think Tatum would be even better than Ingram is right now. But there's no question that Ingram has individually performed. The funny thing is with his numbers, though, is that they're kind of down in key areas. His three-point shooting is down from this past season. His free throw shooting is bizarre. Like, he's never been a good free throw shooter, which is a strange statistic for a guy like that. But I still think that Jason Tatum, and maybe it's because I look at him and I see a physically superior player. Jason Tatum's only in his second year, but I think you can look at Tatum and see kind of the body of a player that's going to be able to do a lot more physically maybe than Brandon Ingram is. I think Ingram's going to continue to get stronger, but I don't know that he's going to fill out and be that kind of physical, overwhelming player that I think Jason Tatum can be.
Certainly. I mean, Tatum definitely has the look of a more prototypical wing that you want moving forward. Again, for Ingram, I mean, you say Tatum, his problems are what we like to call first world problems, Chris, that he doesn't, he has to play with a bunch of other all-stars. Oh, poor him. I mean, Ingram, I mean, look at the way they just changed over the roster. You know, he's just had to deal with so much in L.A., so much upheaval that we have to factor that in. I mean, we can say that Tatum not being a scoring option, I get that, has factored into his development. But you know what's also helped his development? Stable organization, stable coaching, True. Not dealing with trade rumors, not dealing with, you know, massive roster changes, not dealing with a guy like LeBron coming in. So, you know, I do think that that also has to also plays a role here.
I agree. So I think we both kind of agree Tatum, but it's a lot closer, right? I think it's
Definitely.
Fair to say.
Let me put it this way. If the Pelicans end up with Ingram, I don't think they've made some massive mistake. I think that they can still make something out of that.
Yeah, I think that's possible. I wonder how they'll look at it in the next couple of months. All right, let me finish in the rookie class. Luka Doncic this past month won his fourth Rookie of the Month award. He is well on his way to being, you know, maybe unanimous Rookie of the Year when that vote ultimately comes in. At the same time, Trae Young is kind of sneaky climbing up these rookie rankings. I mean, this was a guy that in the month of November averaged 14 points per game. In the month of December, averaged 16 points per game, 18.5 in January. In February, he averaged 23.5. And now, in just two games this month, granted both against the Bulls, he's giving you 33.5 points per game. That's off of a 49-point game he had against the Bulls back on Friday. Trae Young, I mean, he took a pretty good beating from Summer League on. I remember at Summer League, you know, when he was missing shots, everyone was kind of jumping off the Trae Young bandwagon. All of a sudden, we might be looking at a healthy debate, Rohan, about the long-term, who's the long-term better player, Trae Young or Luka Doncic? How do you see this as it's evolved over the last few weeks?
Literally since draft night, since Sports Illustrated's live draft show, I was like...
Yeah, I didn't see that. I was working for that.
I'm sure. Yeah, you still have their email address.
I do, yes.
From that night, I was just saying, can we please, like, end the comparisons? This is unfair to Trae Young. Then he had the rough summer league. Then Luka got off to this hot start, and everyone just wanted to dump on the Hawks. First and foremost, I'm happy for Trae Young. I think he's playing a lot better. I asked him at All-Star Weekend, are you tired of the Luka Doncic comparisons? He said no. He's handled it really, really well. He's definitely closed the gap. The way I look at it is this. Both teams, I think, can build good teams around the player they got, right? I think the Mavs can build a great team around Luka Doncic. I think it's possible the Hawks build a really, really good team around Trae Young one day. So I don't feel this, like, incessant need to compare these guys like that's been happening since draft night. I mean, why don't we give the Suns as much grief for passing Doncic as we do the Hawks?
Like, yeah, I can't remember. DeAndre Ayton, what has he been doing this year? I mean, his numbers are fine, but
I mean, the team sucks. And you drafted a center with the number one pick in 2019. I mean, unless you have an Embiid type, like, who are these? I mean, what's Ayton's ceiling? Like, a better Clint Capella? I mean, Clint Capella's a good player. He's not a building block. I just, whatever. We can debate that pick another time. But I just... It's annoying to me that the Hawks somehow get the target of the Luka derision when other teams pass on him as well. And I think it's the same with Marvin Bagley. You can build good teams around these guys. These guys can be helpful to your organization. So I'm happy for Trae Young. I did just read something today that I think Trae Young is the worst defender at his position in the NBA. So that's something to keep an eye on. That was one of the knocks on him coming into the draft. And that is important. That is something that we should keep an eye on. Obviously, he's a rookie and he'll have time to improve, but... I think what we're seeing is how good Trae Young can be for just being Trae Young, and not just his shooting. Obviously, the shooting gets a lot of attention. The passing, I mean, his passing ability is incredible. I think it was Rob Mahoney who just wrote about that for SI, but I'm happy for Trae Young. And when it comes to the Doncic stuff, I just wish both guys could get appreciated without it having to be, you know, the scale every time, you know, who's got it, who's it in favor of this week.
Oh, it's always been like that, though. It's always going to be like that. From, you know, Durant and Greg Oden, and, you know, go back in history. Number one, you know, Elijah Wan and Jordan. Like,
I mean, sure, I agree, but let's do it with Ayton. Let's do it with Ayton instead.
Oh, yeah, we could throw Ayton in the mix. Yeah. And we shouldn't also forget that the Hawks also got a first-round draft pick out of that deal as well. So that was a really good deal for Travis Schlenk and that front office. And one thing people forget about Trae Young in kind of making these – Steph Curry-like comparison. Steph Curry had 3 years at Davidson. He had 3 years to kind of fill out and get college experience. Trae Young played for Oklahoma, which he basically strapped on his back with four defenders running at him at all times to achieve significant things last year. And now what really encourages me about Trae Young, and he told me this back in November when I went out to see him, but you know, we were talking about the three-point shot, and at that time, he was just really struggling with it. I mean, the month of December, he shot 20% from three-point range, but it's progressively gotten better. It was 35% in January. It was right around there in February. In March, in February, it went up all the way to 44%, and now he's at 52% in the two games he's played so far in March. So it's slowly starting to look like he's developing an NBA shot. And I'm not just talking about those freakish kind of shots from the logo type of things he does every so often, but the consistent, you know, three-point shots that are there for him. He's starting to knock those down. If he can do that, I think the defense, he'll never be a high-level defender, but as he gets physically bigger and is able to contend with some of these bigger guards, like I was watching him these last couple of games against Chris Dunn. Chris Dunn's only been in the league for a few years, but Chris Dunn is so much stronger than Trae Young,
right?
Like physically, like that's going to come for Trae as he gets, you know, past 21, as he will in September. I feel confident he can develop into a serviceable defender in the same way Steph Curry developed into a serviceable defender.
Definitely. And in addition to the, just talking about his all-rounded offensive game, the passing, I mean, he can get to the lane. He's got a lot of variety to his offense that makes him a really good player.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens in the next few years. Rohan, always appreciate it, man. Thanks for coming in to join me this week, and we'll catch you next time.
Always happy to be the Andy to your Conan, Chris.
There you go. Yeah. We like that comparison. My thanks to Rohan Nadkarni for joining the show, and now my conversation with Andre Ingram.
Start by kind of taking me back to the beginning of your basketball journey. I mean, the NBA, a dream for you as a kid. Where did it all kind of start?
Yeah, as a kid, I started like any annoying little brother. I got an older brother, 7 years older than me. I just did everything he did. And so when I tried basketball for the first time, that was kind of it for the other sports. I didn't care for anything else but basketball. And kind of my loves around the Jordan years. I mean, that's kind of like when I started playing and started watching. I was never a big fan of college basketball, never really watched it. The NBA was always kind of the thing for me. So even as I got to an age where I started playing well and playing AAU and kind of seeing that, hey, maybe I can do something with this. Even when I was in high school doing really well, like college wasn't the thought. Not that I was going to go straight to the NBA. I knew that wasn't going to be the case. But all I kind of thought about after high school, which I really enjoyed playing, was, how do we get to the NBA after college? I literally didn't think about, you know, would this be a good college to go to make it to the league? I didn't care. I was like, let me win a high school state championship. That was my first care. And then after that, how can we make it to the NBA?
Jordan fan growing up?
Yeah, definitely Jordan fan my whole life. It's like I said, when I first started playing basketball, he was kind of the one kind of taking over everything. Like, Jordan had, like, the unique ability. When you saw him play, it made you want to go outside and play, too. I don't think I've ever felt that with any other player. You want to try his moves outside and, you know, seeing, like, you know, come fly with me and all of his videos that he had. I watched all of them, man. And all I wanted to do was go outside and play after doing that. I, like, no other player, like, did that to me except MJ.
The high school years, you were a good player.
Yeah.
And did you think the bigger schools would come calling? Even, like, the VCUs would come. Would you think that more would come out of it?
Yeah, they kind of did. Like, I blew up my junior year, and I used to get a lot of letters from UConn, and so I'd put them in, like, my back pocket so, like, the student body could see I'm getting letters from UConn and all this. It was never an offer. It was just kind of, like, information about the school. I did have quite a few schools recruiting me. As I told you, college was never a big thing for me, so during the whole recruiting process, I didn't know how important it was to kind of sign during the early signing period. And if you kind of wait until the end till you win your state championship, well, those scholarships, those offers might be gone. That's what happened with me. Like, my senior year, I told everyone that was interested in me. I had West Virginia, Virginia Tech, VCU, as you mentioned, University of Richmond. I had some, you know, really good schools after me. And I told them all, look, I'm just focused on winning a state championship in high school. It's all I want. And again, you know, college wasn't a big concern of mine. By the time I was done, like by the time my senior year ended and we won the state championship, all that was left was American and William & Mary. And they were the only two schools left. And William & Mary didn't even have a coach at the time. So, yeah, I went with American.
Do you chalk that up to just, you know, not having enough information, not caring enough, or not being...
A little bit of all of it, you know. It's not like today. I'm not big on, you know, TV and, you know, all this stuff anyway. When it comes to sports, you see me, I watch game shows, you know, like I kind of stay away from, you know, that kind of feed. And then I wasn't knowledgeable about the whole process. I didn't have like parents or, you know, my older brother stopped playing basketball after high school. So, and I wasn't a college basketball fan. Like March Madness was cool, but it wasn't like the end all be all for me. So, I kind of chalk it up to all of those things, man. Like NBA game, I watched that all day. College, not really. It was like kind of eh to me. And so, yeah, that's probably why I waited so long. There wasn't a desire or care there, to be honest with you.
When you get to American, is the NBA still the dream? Do you still believe?
Without question. Going to American actually was a good thing for me, like to play a lot and to play well, especially early in my career. I kind of saw that as I never really thought it mattered where you went to school, how well you did, wherever you got to, wherever you were. Obviously, there's stories in the NBA D2 players that making it and things like that. And I pay attention to stuff like that, mid-major schools and players making it. I thought it was beneficial for me to go to a school where I could play immediately, kind of show what I got. And you would always have like one or two big schools you play during the year. And if you show well in those games, you could show that you could play with those guys anyway. So that was fine for me. And the NBA was still always definitely the goal. And so when my college career ended, I mean, that's what I told my my college coach. I was like, look, coach, I want to keep playing. I know it's either overseas or D-League. Obviously, it's going to be D-League for me because in my eyes, that's the most direct route to the NBA.
The big games against the bigger schools.
Yeah.
How did you fare in them?
I did pretty well. My first ever college game was against University of Maryland. And they were good at the time. They had DJ Strawberry, Chris McCray, Nick Caner-Medley. They had a good team. And I played well. I didn't shoot it very well that first game, but I wasn't expecting to. I was a freshman. It's my first ever game. I didn't know what to expect, but I led the team in scoring. I led both teams in scoring. I think I had 16 or something like that. I think I took like 16 shots too to get it, so that wasn't great, but scored well. And yeah, throughout the years, the big teams we played, I did pretty well. Maryland, we played every year just because they were so close to American. Played University of Washington when they had Brandon Roy and Bobby Jones, and that was a big game for me. I played well in that. I might have 20 or something like that. I want to say that was the first game of the season as well. For some reason, we always played the big schools in the early part of the season. But I fared well in all of them. That just did nothing but make me want to go to the NBA even more, kind of seeing the guys who were going to be there.
When did you realize that to get to the NBA, mm-hmm. there was going to have to be another stop along the way? It's going to be more work to do.
Yeah, obviously. So I played well against the bigger schools in college, but I knew I had to take another step to get to the NBA when, you know, my career as a whole probably didn't go as well as the guys being projected to get drafted. And like I said, I'm not into the internet and kind of watching sports shows and all that. So I didn't know draft projections. I just knew I wasn't in it. I had a couple people kind of just like get some fillers about, hey, what do you guys think of Andre Ingham to NBA teams? And they're like, well, he's pretty decent. We'll kind of monitor his career and see what happens. So, I mean, it was no real interest. So, and that was expected. I had never made a tournament in my college career. I had a pretty good career individually, but as a team, we never kind of got to like a national stage where people could see me very well. So I figured it was another stop. I didn't mind that, though. I just kind of, like I said, as soon as it was over, I was like, well, I obviously have to go to the D-League. That's the only route. That's the only option.
So walk me through the decision to go to the D-League. You say it's the only option, but
yeah.
were there other options for you?
Yeah, there were definitely more options than just the D-League for me. There were a couple overseas opportunities for me. My college coach even suggested that I take it overseas. The D-League, you definitely weren't going to make much money at that point when I was first coming in. And my college coach was telling me, hey, a guy with your skill set, you go overseas and, you know, put together a couple good years, you can make a career and, you know, a good life for yourself. And he was right. I mean, I knew it then. I was kind of stubborn and just straight tunnel vision, man. All I could think of was NBA. It's all I ever wanted. So all I could think about was NBA. And just to me, the D-League is the most direct route. So the equation was simple for me. I'm not sure how much real thought I gave to any, you know, overseas opportunity that was there. And there were some there. I think, like, I was like one of the players perfectly pegged for like an overseas gig and, you know, have a good career. And many of the guys in my conference and on my teams, they did that and made very good careers for themselves.
What did you know about the D-League before you got into it?
Not much. All I knew was that this is the NBA minor leagues. That's pretty much all I knew. I didn't know like percentages of how many guys make it to the NBA. Like they have those statistics out now, and you know how many guys have been on D-League rosters throughout their career. I didn't know any of that at the time. I just knew this is the NBA minor leagues. I need to be in it. That's kind of, you know, how I looked at it.
So walk me through kind of the process of entering the G League or the D League draft. Just the, you know, you're done with college.
Yeah.
How do you get involved with the D League?
Yeah, that was my question. So I didn't have an agent and didn't have people knocking down my door to be my agent. So I asked my college coach, Jeff Jones. I said, hey, man, do you have anyone that, you know, can represent me and so I can, you know, take this next step? Cause I don't know what the next step is to get to the D League or how that works. I do know they have a draft, but how do I get in it? And so, yeah, as a favor to me, my college coach put me in contact with an agent of one of his former players. And after that, I got put into a national D-League tryout. It was like 200 guys. They split us up into 20 teams, 10 guys on each team. And, yeah, you just played some scrimmage games. And my team, we had a good team. We ended up going 5-0. The coach for my team actually is an assistant coach with our team right now. I hadn't seen him until 3, maybe 2.5 years ago when he was the coach of this team. I hadn't seen him since that D-League tryout, which was very cool, you know, the things come around full circle. But, yeah, I had a good D-League tryout. They kind of let you play the games, and then they send you home, and they say, well, we'll let you guys know. And you kind of wait for the D-League draft and hope you did well enough in the tryout to get drafted. And I got drafted in the 7th round of that draft to the Utah Flash.
What was it like having to try out again? Be kind of the experienced one?
Yeah, it's in the D-League, it's nerve-wracking. Like, that first year especially, I had no idea what to expect. And I'm seeing the names of the other people they drafted. And some of these guys, like, have went to high major schools, and I know them, I've seen them. Like, you know, these guys have highlight films, and I'm like, man, I'm about to be in training camp with this guy. So it's nerve-wracking, that first year, obviously. But then, you know, the D-League is a yearly contract thing. It's not like anyone signs for 2 or 3 years and they're guaranteed a spot. I've had to make the team every year I've come to training camp. It's always nerve-wracking. It never gets easier. At least for me, it doesn't. I never felt like it's been easy to do that. But you kind of just, you know, hope you put in enough work during the summer, and it usually shows. I'm thankful that it does, because yeah, it's a nerve-wracking situation, man. You can be cut, and then what you gonna do? Because, you know, for me, somebody like myself who has no interest of going abroad, you better make the team, or what else you gonna do? So, yeah, it's nerve-wracking. You know?
The D-League draft itself, did you watch it somewhere? I mean, how did you find out where you were drafted?
I think I was watching my high school team play like a summer league game. I was at VCU Siegel Center, because I'm from Richmond. VCU Siegel Center is near us. And I didn't watch the D-League draft. I don't even know at that time if you could follow it. I don't know. But I got a call, and I think it was the GM of the Utah Flash. And he's like, Andre, we've selected you with our 7th-round pick. And I was with one of my high school teammates who was a really good friend of mine at the time, and I told him, and we were so happy because – you know, when you get that call, your first thought is, oh, man, I'm making it to the NBA like tomorrow. I'm going to this D-League team. I'm going to get a call up, and my story is going to be, you know, that's going to be history. And that's what you think at that time. And then you get to training camp, and you see that you're probably not going to happen this year. And, you know, you just kind of hope you can stick. And, yeah, so that's what happened with me.
Did you have any fears before the draft? Like, maybe I'm not going to get drafted. Then what do I do? What's the
– Yeah, you know what? I don't even think I scared myself like that. I just kind of expected to be drafted because I did do well in that tryout camp or whatever it was. And so I thought I'd get drafted. I didn't know how high or low or whatever. I just wanted to be one of the 10 rounders picked, you know. So to go into seventh, I was feeling pretty good. I was like, okay. And then when I found out that, you know, the team is not only comprised of the draft picks, it's returning players. And Utah Flash was an expansion team, so they also got players from other teams in the D-League. So I was a seven-round pick, but I wasn't like the seventh guy in line. I was more so like the bottom four of all the other players that were coming. So, you know, initially I was, you know, thinking I would get drafted because we did so well in that that tryout camp. But, yeah, I didn't let myself get scared that I wouldn't get drafted.
Richmond, a lot different than Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
What were those first – what was that first year like in Utah?
When I landed in Utah, it was amazing. So I'm from Richmond, East Coast. I'd never seen – real mountains before. Like, that was the first thing I noticed. I got off the plane, I'm like, man, these mountains are huge and they're beautiful. I'm like, what is this place? You know, like, that's how it was. You know, in college, I went to American and we rarely went to the West Coast, if at all, the one time playing University of Washington. So we always kind of stayed in the East Coast, like mid-major teams do. You kind of stay in your area. Never been to the tournament, so I didn't have to travel far. So that was kind of like my first, like, Western Coast experience. And to see those mountains, that was like the first thing. The second thing I noticed was the altitude when we started practicing. I was so tired. I was like, what is this? Like, what's going on in my chest? Like I didn't know what was happening. So, yeah, no, the beauty of it caught me first in Utah. It's very different. And then, obviously, the people are a little bit different. I had no idea about Utah or, you know, that it's just heavily populated with Mormons. I had no idea about it at all. I didn't know. So I just thought, man, these people are really nice. You know, that's how it kind of was for me. And, you know, and then they love basketball. The people do there, obviously the Jazz. And with our team, we had, I don't know, probably I would say in the top three of support, fan support throughout my years in Utah.
On a personal level, your first year out there, like you said, pretty far away from home. Mm-hmm. Did you go, do you have any friends with you? What was it like for you that first year on a personal level?
Yeah, I had no one I knew, so your teammates became your family almost immediately. And I still see that now, to be honest. You know, younger guys tend to gravitate toward younger guys. So I had a group of guys that I kind of gravitated towards and, you know, still keep in contact with to this day. You know, you become family, especially when you don't have, like you said, anyone that you know in the area. Some guys were from kind of that area, so they had people and had cars and everything. But other guys were like me. You came from somewhere that's not close to Utah. You don't know anyone, so all you have is yourselves. And so our routine pretty much got set early. We would practice. We would come home. We would nap. We would go to the mall together, go home and nap, eat, and go home and nap. That was our day, you know. We all did it together, most of the younger guys. Like I said, I still keep in contact with a lot of them.
That first season ends. Mm-hmm. Are you thinking, all right, the NBA's next? I'm going to have to keep coming back. What's your mindset there?
Yeah, so after my first season, I don't know. I want to say early on, all I wanted for that first season was to see if I belonged, to see if I could play with these guys. That's what the first season was for me. It showed me that I could. The second season was more when I started thinking about, okay, I can play with these guys. Let's see if we can get a more increased role, and I think we can make it. So that's what the second year was. But the first year was just, you know, you're so in awe, man. And like somebody in my position, I was, you know, maybe 10, 11, 12 guy on the roster. Didn't play much, probably played like 6 minutes a game my first year, something like that. But, you know, those minutes were valuable to me and practicing with guys who were in the NBA and playing a lot of minutes. I'm like, man, I can do this. So the second year was kind of when it turned to, okay, let's get back to our NBA dream and wanting to do this because we can play with these guys. Let's see what an increased role does and let's keep going after it.
Was at any point in those first couple of years, was money a factor? You know, you said you don't make a lot in the D-League early on. How did that work for you?
Well, I'm a saver. So, like, I save my money. I don't spend a lot at all. So the money part of the D-League for me, especially early, wasn't really a problem. In fact, I was amazed at how much I had left over after the season was over. So it wasn't a problem for me at all. I didn't have kids. I didn't have a wife. You know, I wasn't paying for anybody but me. And so, yeah, I was like, I can make this money work. I'm a saver. My brother went to school for accounting. My dad does income taxes for a living. He still does to his day, 69 years old. So, like, I could stretch a dollar or two. And so the money wasn't too much of a problem for me, especially early on.
And you met your wife in Utah.
I did. I met her toward the end of my first season. I met my wife in Utah towards the end of my first season. And, yeah, my teammate and her cousin were kind of the ones together. And, you know, we were kind of like, I call us the straggalongs. We were the ones that just were on the side, like, okay, waiting for my teammate. She waiting for her cousin. Well, let's just talk, you know. And it took me a while to talk. I'm very shy. So it took quite a while, actually, longer than I like to admit. And she loves telling people that. So, but, yeah, I met her there. And it was at the end of the season, like I mentioned. So that wasn't very convenient because I'm going back home after the season's over. I'm going back to Richmond. So we kept in touch over that summer. And when I decided to come back to Utah, then we kind of got to – together a little bit more often. The rest is history, man. That was like 10, 11 years ago. So, yeah, we've been together since.
And you got married how many, while you were still in Utah or in?
Yeah, I better get this date right. So, yeah, we married in 2013. We married it. So that was after 5 years of being together. And, yeah, so we married after that. And, yeah, got two kids now. And, yeah, we're rolling as a family. Yeah, they go with me everywhere. I love having them around. They've pretty much been with me all of my seasons except for one, and we want to keep it like that. Yeah.
It's certainly one thing to be single and chasing your dream and being okay, like you said, with the money. Mm. Then you have a family, you get married. Did that change your mindset at all?
You know what? It didn't change my mindset when, you know, I had a wife and had kids, and now you have to think about them in the equation when you have not much money in this league. It didn't change my mindset, but it could have had she said something. Like she said, look, maybe you need to consider going overseas or just a different career entirely. You know, you have a degree, you know, you should use it. If she had said anything along those lines, then I would have had to seriously consider that. But to my wife's credit, man, she was so supportive throughout the entire time. It was, okay, where are we playing this season? Are you going back to L.A.? Looking good in your training, and you know, so it was always that encouragement to keep going. I guess I was stretching the dollar well enough that she didn't mind that we weren't making much either. So yeah.
So how's the family dynamic work? You're out playing, you're chasing a dream, and what's happening at home?
Yeah, she's so now our kind of dynamic is like you say. I'm in practice, and you know, she's here helping the kids with homework, picking the kids up from school. Whenever I'm in town, I do it as much as possible just to help her. You know, I know how the kids can be a load. You know, they're 7 and 5. That's a loaded age, you know, where they require a lot of time, a lot of devotion, a lot of energy. So whenever I'm around and in town, I try to help. I try to take the girls to school. I try to pick them up. We try to do those things together. It's not like I just do it by myself and let her rest. We all kind of do things together as much as we can. But, yeah, that's the reality of it. I mean, I'm on the road a lot. We travel a lot, playing a lot. And a lot of it falls on her to make sure our kids on up and up. And for our kids to be doing so well, obviously she has everything to do with it.
When you're coming in the early years coming along, Utah, mm-hmm. and then out in here in South Bay, was there a first time where you have been frustrated about – you know, is this going to happen for me?
Yeah.
And if you were, when was the first time that?
Yeah, I think that's the part most people miss in my story that I always love to tell people about that. You know, Andre Ingram's story is not, man, this guy's in his 11th season in the G League and he just keeps pushing at it because he's always excited about it. That's not the case at all. There were many times I've been frustrated after exhausting those 4 years with the Utah Flash and, you know, all I got from it, you could say all I got from it was one NBA Summer League invite to the Orlando Summer League. You know, I, at that point, had never been invited to a training camp or anything like that, and passing up good overseas opportunities to pursue this thing. And now they're starting to, the overseas opportunities are starting to go away because we haven't taken one yet. So now they're saying, well, he'll never come anyway. And so now you're kind of stuck, you know, you're like you're not making it in the D-League. You're not seeing any evidence of things getting better. You know, you're fighting with call downs coming from the NBA team that kind of takes your minutes when you get on a good roll. All the things that D-League players experience, and it's frustrating at times because you know, kind of see no end to it. You kind of see no light at the end of the tunnel. That happened often for me. And, you know, whatever kept me going, there was always something. Like people so inspired by my story to keep going, but I mean, the product of me going myself was other people's stories.
Keeping with kind of the frustration part of it. Do you remember the first kind of crossroads you came to where you wondered, should I keep going? Should I try something else?
Yeah, the first kind of real bout with frustration for me during this whole D-League journey was after my fourth season in Utah. Our team went defunct, so there was no more Utah Flash, and I had exhausted 4 years and a lot of opportunities elsewhere that I could have had overseas, and at this point, I kind of felt like I was no closer than when I started. You know, still hadn't got a training camp invite. I thought the Jazz organization liked me, and I would get some sort of invitation somewhere to do something. I did get a summer league invite, but that was 2 years prior to my fourth season in Utah. So these last 2 years, kind of nothing's happening, nothing's going on. I've just been turning down offers to go elsewhere and not really seeing anything happening here. And so our team went defunct, and our rights got moved to LA Defenders, and now, you know, thinking about going to a new team and kind of starting over again. It was just frustrating. I was like, I don't know if I want to do this. And then my first child was born during that time. And so that season where our rights got moved to the LA Defenders, I didn't even join them to start the season. And part of that was first child being born and my wife was finishing school. So I needed to, I had to work. I was working in Utah, actually. You know, my wife was finishing school and, you know, just doing the work thing. And I'm watching D-League games, and I'm like, man, I would have did this. Man, I would have did that. And that frustration turned into, I kind of want to do this again, all right? And so the L.A. Defenders coach knew me, called me, wanted me to play. And so I joined them to end the season and had a pretty good run again and kind of got my juices back going again to kind of keep going.
Off seasons for you.
Yeah.
What were they like?
Yeah. So for D-League players, it's not like we go in the off season to our big homes in whatever cities we're in or whatever city we choose. No, for me and my family, I do go home back to Richmond on the East Coast. And with my wife and kids now, we stay with my parents at times just to parents can see the grandkids and stuff like that. We enjoy that time of the summer. We do visit my wife's family who's in Arizona. So we kind of travel a lot during the summer. That's our travel time, and that's how we spend our vacations, just visiting family. It's not like we're pent up in a house somewhere just enjoying all the spoils of life. That's not what we're doing. And you really can't do that for the money you make in the D-League. But like I said, it's a journey, man, that I just, you know, have been on, and that's part of what you have to accept and go through if you're going to stay in and kind of chase this thing.
So are you working in off seasons?
Yeah.
Yeah,
so you have to continue working in the off season with our salaries. For me, I do two specific things. I do tutoring for high school mathematics, middle school, college prep tests, things like that. Math is just, it's just in our family. I told you we're a family of savers. My brother accounting, my dad income taxes. So numbers have kind of just come easy to us. And so I enjoy keeping that part of me alive, because everything else I learned in school is gone. It's gone. My major, I majored in physics, that's gone. Any Spanish that I once knew is gone. Any and everything is gone but the math. And so I love doing it. I love tutoring. And I do it heavy over the summer. And in season, I'll do it here from time to time when we have some free time. But also train high school and middle school kids in basketball, and that kind of keeps us afloat too.
When you're math tutoring, mm-hmm. Do kids kind of look at you and be like, wait a minute, do you play, like, do you ever get recognized as a math tutor?
I tutored for a while, and I don't think people started noticing, like, who I really was until after the call-up. Obviously, that was big, but some of my kids didn't know that I played ball. I told them about my team and stuff, and they'll look it up. You know, the internet now, they just type it in, and, hey, I see you won 3-point contest, and, hey, that's pretty cool. And then when the call-up happened, it was just like, you know, now the parents are like, okay, can we still use you? Is that okay? You know, and I'm like, yeah, I need to keep that part of me alive. Like, I don't want to forget everything I've learned. So,
so out here, how much tutoring do you do?
So not much now. I got like one or two students that I still Skype with over the season. One just last week or so. And he's doing geometry. Even for people that like math, geometry is not fun. But again, I love keeping it alive. So I don't have too many students now. In season, a lot of the parents, you know, like to ease off of me. I tell them all the time, look, I have free time. So I don't mind doing it. So a lot of them try to save me from myself. But I enjoy it. So, you know, I try to encourage kids. Yeah, man, if you need some help, just call me. I tell my family and friends that too. So, yeah.
What was it like to, as you're continuing to play in the D League or the G League, all the time, there's new young 21, 22-year-olds hustling, trying to take your spot and trying to, I mean, what was that? How was that experience the last few years?
Yeah, you know what? For me, it's been, and you're right, when you're at this stage or a veteran, as I'm seeing now, and you got younger kids coming in out of college thinking the same way I thought when I first got into D-League, oh, I'm in the D-League now, I'm going to the NBA, it's going to happen very fast. Now they kind of look to me for advice. It's kind of different now. When I first came in, it's like you said, it's more like a competition thing. I will say about the guys I played with here recently, it's kind of been more, you know, hey, can you mentor me? Hey, how do you handle this? How do you handle that? Because the G League's an interesting place, and it's unique, you know, how your time can fluctuate, your minutes and your play and just everything about it. The team roster changes. The G League, unlike any other league, the team you start with almost never is the team you end with, you know, and that's kind of rare in the sports period, but the G League especially. I've never been on a team that's been the same start to finish.
So the last couple of years, wild ride for you in both ends of the spectrum. Before I get to the Lakers, tell me about Australia. And you said you turned down overseas stuff before.
Yeah.
Walk me through what happened with Australia.
Yeah, so Australia came after my ninth season in the D League or G League. And so, yeah, I took a deal with an Australian team, the Perth Wildcats. And I was supposed to go a lot earlier than I actually went. To rewind it back a little bit, I spoke to them in the summer over Vegas Summer League. I wasn't playing in the Vegas Summer League. They just invited me out there to talk with me. They had seen me play. And at this point, if I thought 4 years in that I wasn't getting any close to NBA opportunity, then 9 years in and still hadn't gotten anything, I was like, well, I'm not sure if it'll ever happen. But people were still interested in me for some reason. I did have some good years. It's never like I had a down year where they or anyone couldn't see that I couldn't play. It wasn't like my skills were deteriorating. It's just people were still taking notice. And so the Australian team, Perth Wildcats, they invited me to Vegas Summer League to just talk with me about playing for them. And I actually got very excited. If you want to have your first overseas experience, you know, Australia, you can't beat that, I don't think, you know. And you know, everyone knows the language. I think it's a place where your kids and your wife would be safe and, you know, all those good things. So we were excited. I called my wife and told her about it. And I'm like, look, this is our new life, and would have been more money than I ever made in my career. So, like, you know, that part was obviously appealing as well. Long story short, though, when it came time to go for preseason, they had actually signed someone else, so they didn't go with me. And so that was a lost opportunity. But right before the G League season was about to start that year, and I still hadn't committed to the G League at that point. Again, that was nine seasons I'd put in already. You know, what's a 10th season going to do? They called me right before training camp was to start, and they said, hey, well, things aren't working out with so-and-so, are you still in shape? Can you still come? I'm like, of course I can still come. When do I need to come? Like, we got like 2 days. I was like, okay, it's kind of quick. And the family can't come with me probably. My girls are in school at this point. So I just go. And I went, and, you know, I went excited. And I think that's important, to go expecting things to go well. So you give yourself a shot at it. This is my first ever trip going overseas or trying to play overseas. So I wanted to give it an honest shot. So I went excited. And then I get there, and, you know, first day is kind of second day kind of maybe just trying to get used to the time zone or whatever. We play a game almost immediately when I get there, which I love, because at this point I don't like practicing. I like playing games. You know, the more quicker we can get to the games, the better. We won. I had a decent game, and things are seemingly well, but there's still that excitement that I had going there hadn't really continued, hadn't really followed me, and quite the opposite, actually. We're winning games. I'm in a beautiful country and just a new experience, new teammates. Teammates are great. Coaching staff is cool. And I'm not enjoying it at all. Whether it's the family, whether it's being so used to the G League for so many years, whatever it is, I'm not well. I'm not excited. I'm unhappy. I'm, you know, sad. There's depression coming in, and kind of one of the first times I'd felt that when you have such positivity around you. You're in a good place. You're about to make more money than you've ever made. You know, you're playing well. You're winning games. You're with a winning team. New experience. And all these are positive things. Why are we not feeling like that? And so I lasted in Australia about 10 days. And after that, I had to tell the head coach, of like, look, this is not going to work for me. And even as I talked with him, it was one of the hardest conversations I ever had. I couldn't quite fully explain to him, you know, how I wanted to put it in words, what I was feeling. But they did release me from our contract. They let me go home. And I was hoping to join the G League immediately after that because they hadn't started training camp yet. But I'd missed the deadline for returning players. So I had to wait at home for 5 months before I could play in the G League again. And that was a hard 5 months. It was slow. Took forever. And seeing people every day, hey, when are you going to play again? When are you going to play again? I don't know, man. I'm just going to work until I can play again. And, you know, eventually got the call that I could come back to the G League. And, yeah, that was a tough time. But ended that season in the G League playing very well again. And so, you know, 10th season, hey, I might as well just keep going after it. I don't know. I don't know what the end is going to be in all of this, but I have no other direction elsewhere. And this is what I know how to do. So,
yeah. So take me through the, you come back from Australia, mm-hmm. and like you said, you can't get on a G League team. So do you mm-hmm. go back to Richmond?
Yeah.
You worked out. Just walk me through, like, tell me about those 5 months.
Yeah. So after leaving Australia, I go straight back to Richmond, which is home. And yeah, I'm just working out. I'm training for work and for money purposes. I'm tutoring heavy. I'm training kids heavy and then training myself as well. And, you know, again, that's for 5 months. That was my life. It was tutoring. It was training. It was training myself, training others. And that was the 5 months. And I'm steadily keeping in contact with the G League coach here saying, hey, coach, you know, I'm ready. Whenever you guys have a spot, whenever things open up, I'm here. I'm ready. And I will be ready when you guys are, you know, ready to go. And, you know, 5 months is a long time. So, you know, you don't think it at some point in that 5 months, I was probably like, hey, you know, might not happen. But I'd gotten to a point mentally where it didn't matter if it was going to happen or not. I was going to be okay. I was going to work for it and train for it. And if the time came, then great. And if it didn't, we're going to have to figure something out. But at least mentally, I was back. And that was big for me.
So during that 5 months, how seriously were you thinking about a post-playing career, that maybe this was the end and mm-hmm. I'm going to have to do X, Y, or Z?
Yeah, you know, during that 5 months, I'm not sure if I ever thought it's time for post-playing career plans. I just kind of thought if I'd never got a call to play that season, where I'd just join training camp next season. So, you know, I was training so hard and training was going well. It was, you know, really going well. I was, you know, shooting the ball extremely well. So I was like, man, I mean, you still got this gift. And I don't think it's time to say goodbye just yet. So if we don't, you know, get the call this year, you just start over again in training camp. Just start over again, you know, because you still have it. So keep using it.
What was your family's, what were their opinions? Your wife and also you're back in Richmond, so you got your parents, your father and your brother. What were they saying to you?
Yeah, you know, it's an excellent question about how my family felt at that time. And they would probably answer it better for you. But if I think about it now, they were probably just hoping for me. They had seen how low I'd gotten, and it was probably just filled with hope. I would venture to say they were probably saying to themselves, yeah, maybe it is time to do something post-play. Hey, man, you, like you say, you have a degree, you can do other things, you're intelligent, you know, kind of use those skills and abilities you have. And I venture to say they were thinking that, never outright told me that. But they probably were thinking it. I think overall it was just a big hope that something breaks because, you know, our son, our brother, our husband doesn't look like himself. So, yeah, they were probably just hoping pretty big for me.
So it wasn't too long that something did break.
Yeah.
And everybody's seen the video of you getting that call up. But from your perspective, I mean, were you having a good year up until that point? Did you expect something to happen in the moment itself? Just take me through it.
Yeah, you know, one of the best parts about the whole Australia ordeal in the 5 months after was the change in mindset for me. It turned from not worrying about the results or the outcome, but that we're just going to do this and kind of see what the end is going to be. We don't know what it's going to be. We know what we hope for. If it doesn't, if it's not that, have you given your best effort at it? If you can say that, like, you get to that point when you're struggling mentally, you kind of wonder why, and you kind of break everything down to, you know, its simplest form. And at the end of the day, if you gave all of yourself in a single day and you do it every day, and that's exactly what I do, how can you be, you know, upset, sad, or disappointed in what happens? So that's what happened when I came back from Australia and finished the season with the Defenders the year prior. And then the year of the call-up, that entire season, yeah, I did play well. I had a very, very good season. There was one stretch in it early on in that season where I'd struggled shooting the ball specifically like I'd never had. And that was weird for me. But at that point, again, mentally I was different. So it didn't break me like it may have would have when I was attached to outcome a little bit more. Was I doing the right things? Was I getting my shots up? Was I putting in the work? Yes. So, I mean, it has to turn. It just has to. We're just going to keep going. It's not like I'm going to stop. And things did turn. And I started, you know, playing lights out kind of to end the season. And we had a good season, made it to the semifinals. And actually, at that point, I was kind of thinking about winning a G League title. I'd been a part of G League 10 years, hadn't won a title, been in three different finals, lost all of them. And so at this point, we're in the playoffs. I'm like, man, maybe this is the year we win a title. You know, maybe you walk out after that. I don't know. But we make it to the semifinals and lose. And the end of a season is so abrupt. It just stops and it's over. And you don't feel like it should be over. Your body feels great, or my body did at least. I felt great. I felt like I could play tomorrow if I had to. But the season was over. And, you know, then 3 days later, I'm sitting at home doing nothing. We're just waiting for exit interviews. 3 days later, you get the call for your exit interview, and it turns into something, obviously, that everyone's seen. And
let me say, that was business as usual. The exit, the phone call, where you were supposed to go, up until when it happened, that was basically what you expected?
Yeah, when we lost in that semifinals game, everyone's just here in the hotels just waiting for your call for your exit interview. And I've been to 10 exit interviews at this point, so I know how that goes. And they told me some cameras would be following me just to document it. So they hit it pretty well. And I get up there and we go to this big conference room. So I'm like, okay, something's different, because I've had exit interviews before. You meet with the GM, you meet with the coach, it's 3 minutes apiece. Hey, how's your season go? What are your plans for next season? Any suggestions? That's how exit interview goes. This was not how it went. So started putting two and two together. And after the magic happened, man, I was like, okay, I've done nothing in 3 days. So this call up is great and all. Obviously, I'm excited. I'm happy. I have to touch a basketball. I haven't moved, ran, or jumped in 3 days. Like, that's an eternity, you know, for, you know, basketball players. And then I start thinking, you know, well, had we made it to the G League Finals, I wouldn't have this opportunity. That's just how things work. So started being thankful for not winning a championship at this point. So, yeah.
I would imagine those phone calls telling family members got to be some of the best phone calls you could make.
Yeah, because they were able to let out the real emotion that they had. I'm in front of Magic Johnson, Rob Pelinka. I'm not going to go crazy in there. Like, but when I call my wife and my mother, I can hear in the background, they're like yelling. There's like the raw emotion that was inside of me. So, yeah, it was a great feeling. And no doubt I thought about, you know, the whole mental reset, the whole Australia ordeal, the whole 5 months. No doubt. I mean, that was kind of the first thought. It wasn't the great season. It wasn't, oh, man, this guy stuck in it for 10 years and, you know, just kept going. What a story. No, it wasn't that. It was, I was really down. And, you know, a change in mindset, keep going after it, and this happened. I was grateful. I was really grateful. I was obviously excited, but grateful. Yeah.
Did you have a practice before the first Laker game?
Nope. No practice at all before the first Laker game. All we had was a shoot around. My practice was after, immediately, so everyone sees the video with Magic and Rob and all of them, and immediately after that video, I head downstairs in the gym to shoot, because like I said, I hadn't touched the ball or did anything. That was the only practice I got. You know, the next day it was shoot around and then the game. And then there was another game after that. So I never got to practice with the team. I just had one shoot around. And, yeah, man. But the good thing about the G League, we run the same system and stuff. So they sent me some film about their calls, but it's the same plays. And so, yeah, that was the extent of my practice.
Walking into the Staples Center, into that Laker locker room, and seeing your jersey hanging there, what was that like?
Yeah, you know, people ask about that moment when I walk into Staples and, you know, you finally see your jersey in the locker room and, you know, there's a lot of pictures of me holding the jersey and stuff like that and, you know, that special moment. Like, for me, it was a cool experience. Don't get me wrong. But for me, the moment, I tell people this all the time, the moment was when you're actually in the game and nothing special, not a jump shot, not a, you know, not you doing something extra great, but just running up and down the court a couple times. And like, man, you're in the NBA. You're part of it. You're in it. Yeah, you're in the game. I love the game of basketball. I like how you have to communicate and how you set the right screen and, you know, then slip and you're open and, you know, just basketball in general, the way the game works. This stuff does not, you know, making the threes, obviously, that part was great. But just, I think, my brother said, like, he saw me get a rebound and he just knew I was okay, you know, because, like, obviously everyone's worried for you. But he saw me run up and down a couple of times, get a rebound, just kick it up to the point guard, and you're in the game. Like, that was the moment for me. So, yeah.
When you're sitting there on the bench, are you sitting like, please call? Are you wondering if you're even going to get your name called to come into a G League call-up?
Yeah, no. Luke had told me I was going to play. So when I'm on the bench, actually I wasn't even on the bench. The bench was full. Some injured guys and all of us, and so I didn't even have a seat. But that was fine for me because before I get in, I like to stretch anyway, like just to, you know, re-stretch afterwards. I'm not as young anymore where I can just sit on the bench for like 10 minutes and then just get right back up. No, I like to sit down anyway and kind of just stretch before I get in. And so I'm over there stretching, and I remember Kuzma asking me, are you nervous? And I'm like, no, I think I'm all right. And Luke called me up there, and yeah, man, I go to check in. So it was perfect, actually. I didn't have a seat I could stretch, and it was kind of worked out perfect timing.
I mean, you're significantly older than a lot of the guys in the locker room.
Yeah.
What did you feel like?
No, they treated me like one of the guys. You know, obviously I was older than all of them pretty much, and they just treated me like one of the guys, man. They were so happy for me. Everyone was just so happy for me. You know, like, the teammates, like, I'd never played with them before, and they just accepted me like it was nothing. Were encouraging me, shoot everything you touch, shoot everything. Like, obviously, I'm not going to do that. But that's what they were telling me. Coaching staff, the assistants, trainers, managers, teammates, everyone, just shoot it every time you touch it. And they were serious, man. They, you know, they were intentional about me getting the ball and shooting and just enjoying the moment. It helped. Yeah, they just welcomed me right in. Mm-hmm.
The reality is, you know, you get a little more money when you're getting called up like that. What did that do for you and your family?
Yeah, that part was huge. Unfortunately, it's prorated and I played two games. So, I mean, it was still cool. I think with most things, being a part of the experience is, you know, more important than, you know, what you get from it. So, yeah, but obviously, yeah, I will take it. I'm not going to turn it down. But, that was big for our family. And obviously, the moment being what it was and being here in L.A. Did something as far as off-the-court opportunities as well. So, you know, that was just something, like, you can't plan for that. Like, when you know, working hard and go back to that point, are you doing what you're supposed to do or can do every day to – you know, make yourself the best player you can be? If so, how can you be upset about that? And then what may happen as you do that are things you don't expect. And so that's kind of what's happening for me.
Did it surprise you, the massive amount of interest in your story as it happened?
Yeah, it did surprise me quite well that the reach of this story. My wife and I, we don't have Instagram, we don't have Twitter, Snapchat, any of that. We have a shared Facebook account. That's our extent of social media. So we had no idea to know just how many people saw the story, how many people loved it, how many people were encouraged, inspired by it. My brother and my niece were the ones telling me, hey, you have no idea how big your story is. It's everywhere. Rappers are talking about it. Movie stars, other NBA players, Hall of Kobe, you know, like, like, really? Like, you know, what do you say to that? You know, like I said, we have a shared Facebook account. We had 200 friends, you know, because, you know, like, that's it. And for that, you know, I mean, I had no way how to feel. I didn't know how to handle it. Either of us, you know, it was that's 0 to 100 really, really fast, 2 or 3 days. And what I love most about it is everything that we've seen, everything that people tell us about it, is every comment, every post, every word about it was positive. You rarely get that in anything, you know, which is kind of why we stay away from all the, you know, social media things. But for it all to be positive, I mean, what can you say to that?
For a lot of people, it's kind of where the public knowledge of your story kind of ends. Like, all right, you made the Lakers, but for you, it's next step. It's
without,
like, you know, when does kind of the rush wear off and you sort of realize, you know, back to work and what's next?
Yeah, so for me, it's not hard to go straight from, man, this big, great experience to let's get back to work. For me, that's not hard. It's kind of who I am. What so many people, coaches especially, were telling me, hey, I know you like to get right to the next thing. Enjoy it. You know, this is special. This is different. Enjoy this, please. Because they know me and they know how I am. And they were just, you know, just really begging me to just enjoy the moment. And take it in. Take in the moment was kind of like the biggest, you know, phrase I'd heard. And I tried, I did. And, you know, you try to take it in and, yeah, this is really cool. Obviously, I didn't do that. Like, I, you know, after the second game, I was like, man, okay, how do I make a training camp? You know, it was that feeling again, which sounds cool. It sounds good. It sounds like what you want to do. But I look back at it, I wish I did enjoy it a little more. Like, I only when this current season started did I look back and say, was I able, I like to say I was able to look back and say, man, that was a really cool moment. And not that I missed the time to enjoy it then, but they were right. I probably should have breathed a little bit and enjoyed it then, but just how my mind works, I was just already thinking about getting to a training camp next year and kind of continuing this thing. But yeah, I'm able to enjoy it now. So I'm at a good place about it, yeah.
So take me through what happened. You know, summertime comes. Mm-hmm. Are you in summer league? Are you, mm-hmm. and you get to the training camp time? Do you get any calls there? Just the whole last few months of the offseason.
Yeah. So my initial thought was that I would have to do summer league, and I'm fine with it. Whatever to get into training camp, just let me know. And I was, you know, told that, you know, summer league I didn't need to be a part of. People know what I can do, and, you know, that was. That summer league is an opportunity to, A, look at younger guys and just see what people have and see what they can do. But they kind of knew what I bring to the table as far as skills and abilities and, you know, what I can do. So I was told that was not a requirement for me. So I was like, okay. So then it just became all about training camp and getting in with somebody. Obviously, I'm hoping it's the Lakers in L.A., but they had bigger plans this offseason, and rightfully so. Let's just say that, rightfully so. It wouldn't have minded to meet whatever team. But I guess my biggest and deepest roots of relationship was here. And so when I didn't get a camp invite from anyone else, you know, it, like, a bit surprised, but, you know, not totally. I mean, the age thing is, it's real. And I accept that. That's fine. But much like college for me, well, there's no other decision. We're going to the G League and we're going to try again. And, as long as the wife is on board, we're good to go. So yeah, that was kind of what it was for me.
So it wasn't difficult then to kind of get yourself in the mental place, like after reaching kind of the proverbial mountaintop, mm-hmm. to kind of get back into it and start the grind all over again.
Yeah, no, it wasn't hard at all. Not too hard. I mean, was getting anxious toward that time when training camp was happening. We were said to be close with a couple of teams, but once we didn't get it, it was kind of like that mindset of the D-League draft coming out of college. Well, if I don't make it, okay, but you know, we kind of know the route and direction we want to go. So, no, if it doesn't happen, go to the G League, dude, and try it again.
So the last question I have is, as you're sitting here, mm-hmm. Coming towards the end of another G League season, are you in the mindset of, I'm going to keep playing until the wheels fall off, the song, somebody let me play, yeah. I'm going to play, or what is it something else?
Yeah, you know what? I do get asked that a lot about how I think about, the end. I've never really thought about putting a date on it as far as keep playing till the wheels fall off or otherwise. Obviously, a big part of me, who I am and my story, is a story of faith, obviously. That's real for me. I go where led. As I look back over my career and I got to this point when we were talking about that mental reset, I look back on all the opportunities I passed up to go abroad, and you kind of get to the root of why. And, that's my faith leading me there. And that's why I can be accepting of everything that came prior to the call up and even now. And that's what it's going to be for here going forward. Till I'm directed otherwise, this is it. And it could happen this season. It could happen next season. I may go on for five more. I don't know. To be capable and able, I'm just thankful for that. That doesn't mean I'm just going to keep going just for my own selfish reasons. Obviously, something bigger is in play here. Someone needed that story. That's bigger than me. So I listen to that. That's what it's going to be for me for the end of this season and so on. To feel good enough and feel like I can do it, that's important, obviously, but it's bigger than natural.
Did you hear from a lot of people, obviously you don't have social media, so it's hard to do that, but about, your story inspiring them?
I did. I hear from a lot of people, whether we're in the airports traveling to road games, to hear from so many, especially on the road, when you're in Austin, Texas, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Stockton, California, wherever we're playing at, wherever, Rio Grande Valley, all these D-League cities and G-League cities. I hear from fans and, after the game, prior to the game, doing warm-ups, genuine people who've just been, I can't tell you how many, not just basketball players, but people that told me they're going to keep going in whatever profession. Cosmetics, acting, it doesn't matter, whatever the field is. I hear it all the time, and I didn't know how to handle all of it at first. Is coach going to be okay with me taking pictures before the game? Does he need me focused? Does he, I've gotten better at that, but, you can't beat people's genuineness of appreciation to you. You can't beat it. So I'm thankful to hear from everyone I do. They keep me going, it's one thing to keep going for yourself, but when you hear somebody say, man, I didn't give up because of you, that does something to you, it's been amazing.
Anybody's story resonate with you that you remember, that anybody that came up to you in all those times at the airports before games, anybody's that was like, wow, that's real?
I will say, during the summer, obviously I was on TNT, and I talked with Kenny Smith, and he told me his wife, he actually put his wife on the phone for me to talk with her, and he showed me a video that she sent for me and say it was something to do with her acting, and she wanted to keep going in that, and she was working out or something. She sent me a video, and she said, I'm doing this because of you. Blown away, man, blown away. And I'm a game show watcher, so I've seen her on The Price is Right. I know the TNT crew, blown away, just blown away. That's one distinctive story. It's the story I can remember. There are others out there, but just everyone's story, man. Like I said, the best part is it's not just athletics. It's everything. It touched people in so many ways. Yeah.
You got yourself a nice award there. 400 plus. How did you find out that you were inching towards that mark. And what was it like to, you know, something I'm sure that was never a dream of yours here coming up?
Yeah, I found out about the games play streak much like I found out about all the other things that like I'm getting close to. Like our media people would tell me, you know, we don't look to it, we don't look forward to it, or you know, search after these things. They play long enough, some of these things are going to happen. And so our media people told me as we inched up close to it. The interesting thing about the games played streak, if you tell anybody that in the beginning of their career, man, you're going to play the most G League games ever. Like, you'd almost be offended, you know, like, it's not a badge of honor. Now I look at it as kind of a badge of honor. It's just, like I said, man, it goes back to it. Did you do everything in the day you were supposed to? Did you give it your all? If you did, be proud of whatever comes with that, you know. So I'll take 402 in the minors. I'll take it, yeah.
All right, that's it for this week's episode. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it, and I'll see you next week.
At Kroger Pharmacy, Care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.